We welcome to the studio Karen Bobka, senior partner and of Holborn Assets and financial advisor behind the blog financialuae.me.
Nice to see you.
And you, and you've got a new post up, and it's everything, obviously, let's run through your blog. What's going on there at the moment?
Well, a new article up this morning is part of the Need to Know series that I randomly put articles up. And this is quite a lengthy one. It's for people who are moving to Dubai. So it's financial tips. I mean, obviously, there's an awful lot of issues to cover for people that are moving here. But this is the main financial points people may not be fully aware of, and just to make sure that they pick up a few important tips before they move here.
And this is a topic that I wanted to bring up today. It is the time of the year. A lot of people are looking at moving to the UAE. They're coming to the UAE. So basically, it's like, where do they start? And I've seen on quite a few forums, as I go and troll those, as you do, it's always good for talking topics. And a lot of people asking, basically, what do I need to have in place financially before I even get to the UAE? And it's something that people do need to consider, because until you have that residence visa, that work permit, you can't get your bank account, you can't do a lot, really.
True.
To begin with,
it's very limiting, isn't it? And you know, I'm sure there's people thinking, is there anyone actually moving here? Well, we know for a fact that
there
they are. I mean, we're all seeing the removal trucks. That last week seemed to be particularly noticeable for that. Did anyone else spot that? Where I was living, there was like two or three trucks a week in the area of people leaving. But I'm expecting them to come the other way,
yep,
shortly. So there are definitely people moving out here, and obviously it's summer transition. And yeah, the thing is, people need to be aware that it's costly to move here. And I think often, even if someone's coming out with a job, they maybe not be aware of all the incidentals to get them started. If you're moving out, and if you are going to a job and you've got accommodation provided for a while, what you have to remember that you've still got costs to pay out before you get your first paycheck, mm-hmm, before you do anything like that. So number one for many people, I would say, is make sure you've got a load of cash with you, because there are things that you're going to want to do and you're going to want to pay for. And it's surprisingly expensive it's expensive to move house, we know that, but to move country as well, there's additional costs there. So you need a float to keep you going.
And once you get here, obviously, before people get there, they're looking at employment contracts and what should and what shouldn't be in those contracts. You've got to look at all these things before you even start and set foot in the country, haven't you?
I'd like to think so, but I do find that a lot of people haven't, or they've kind of assumed, because Dubai is so Western in very many ways, there's almost an assumption that things here will be just like they are in a home country. Mm. And there's this sort of veneer of complete Westernness, and it's just like it was. And I suspect there are some recruitment people internationally who themselves are not aware of the differences here, and so don't flag up the differences to people. And I suppose it's exciting, isn't it, to be moving out,
yeah,
here, to be moving to another country. It all seems terribly exciting and glossy and glamorous, as it does. So people will overlook the nitty-gritty, perhaps not so exciting, important things that they do need to look at, because things like all the legal issues, they're all there online if you take the time to go and find them. But it's taking the time and finding them in all the different places that people don't always do.
And one thing that you highlighted, and it's something that we need to bring up, but as you've just touched on, banking and the way things work is different. We have Sharia compliant banking here. And I've been here so many years, and I'm still confused as to what this actually means.
Right.
And a lot of people look at it and go, well, what does that actually mean at the end of the day when you're dealing with your finances?
Right. Well, when it comes to the banks, there are ones that operate on a Sharia system, and some that operate more like a Western bank in terms of the way they actually operate on a day-to-day basis. It's a question of interest. If a bank is Sharia compliant, it doesn't pay interest. It may give you a return on savings, but there's a slightly different way of operating. For many of us on a day-to-day basis, we're not really going to see a difference, but things are structured slightly differently in terms of loans, interest rates, that kind of thing. That's the main difference for many of us there. But the Sharia thing is the one that people do need to be aware of. And sadly, I have seen the assumptions of people kind of assuming, because they are not Muslim and because they're not Emirati or GCC nationals, that these things won't apply to them. It applies to everybody who is in the country, whether they are tourist and resident, and that's a fact, and you need to be aware of it. And clearly, the big one with banking and the legal system here is the issue of debt, non-payment of debt, bouncing of checks, where it is a criminal offence, where it is not in many of the countries that we come from. Mm-hmm. So people can be a little blasé, shall we call it, about not worrying about if they've missed a payment or a check bounces, because they'll make it up. Here, there can be very, very serious consequences of non-payment. And I think it's, and although it sounds very negative, I think it's important that people are aware of all the downs as well as the ups of moving somewhere like this.
And there's a topic that I do want to touch on a little bit later, and the culture of kind of living on credit, as it were. And I've got a couple of examples and a couple of stories and a couple of questions with regards to that as well. But when people come here and choosing a bank, it can be quite difficult. I mean, some people, they'll basically get stuck with the financial institution that their company uses, because the company might go and open a bank account for them on their behalf. That certainly used to happen when I first arrived. The company went, we'll open all your accounts for you because this is who we deal with and that's who you're going with, and that's it, end of story. But you kind of have to do your research and find out which financial institution is going to be best for you at the end of the day.
Yeah, and we do have the benefit that most banks have pretty decent websites. The information is there if you want to find it. And I don't necessarily think that going with the bank that your employer is with is a bad idea. I mean, certainly in the past, if you remember, the theory was always that if you were on a salary, you would be paid quicker if you were with the same bank, because it went in the same day as opposed to having a lead-in time. I'm not sure that's the case anymore. And it certainly was back in the day. But there's issues like, does the bank have a branch that you can get to if you need to? Is that relevant to you? Because obviously some banks only have a handful of branches. And if they're nowhere near where you live or work, that can be quite inconvenient, albeit that most banks here are open on a Saturday if you're not working and you don't mind standing in a queue. But there's that consideration. And there are certain banks here that have way more branches than others. And that could be a big plus as far as you're concerned, if you like to go into the bank and do transactions. But you need to consider charges on an ongoing account. How generous or helpful are they if you think you will need to get a loan for a specific purpose? Not that we're particularly encouraging that down the line. If you want a credit card and they're a useful tool, what are their offerings there?
And one thing for me that's a good consideration is how good their online banking is. I'm one of these people, I refuse to go to the branch. I hate having to go to the branch. I don't want to have to go and deal with people. It sounds awful to say.
I'm with you.
Or over the phone. And it's like, but you need to come down and sign for this. And it can be something really, really simple. And I'm like, well, can't I just email you the details?
Any day. There's time management though, isn't it?
Yes.
I think that in 11 years of being here, I'm fairly sure that I've only been into my bank like 3 times. I'm really proud of that. The online banking works well. I've had to make the odd phone call for minor issues, and it's been fairly good. But yeah, I'm totally with you on the online banking.
I love that. It's Emma Brain in for Suzanne Radford, and we're talking finances in this first hour. We've got Karen Bobka, senior partner at Holborn Asset and creator of the blog financialuae.me, in the studio with me. And we've got some SMSs and some basically people looking for some advice. I've got one in here saying, I'm in a complete financial mess. I've got loans and cards. Is there anything I can do for advice? I have 3 cards and a loan amounting to around 200,000 dirhams. Someone who owed me 300,000 ran off, but I spent the money before I got paid, and now I'm in a bind. What do I do?
Tough one. I mean, clearly I would need to know a lot more to advise on that one. My first question would be whether he is behind on any of the repayments, or whether he's managed to keep his, keep himself afloat and keep the payments going, because that is so important to keep the payments going. Once you fall into arrears, then the banks become less amenable in terms of helping you out. And in a situation like that, if his total amount outstanding is 200,000, that's a fair chunk of money, but it is nothing like the worst that I have seen in any respect. And depending on his income, it may well be that what he simply has to do is sit down, work out his income, his outgoing, see if he has got ways of reducing his outgoings. Are there any other assets that he has anywhere, or items that he can sell to start paying off some of those debts? Because in many cases, it is possible to get back, but it's a long road that needs a lot of discipline to get the payments. So it depends on his total earnings and his situations, what he can and can't do. And there are cases sometimes where the bank will reschedule borrowings. But, and here's the two buts. One, you need to be largely up to date with your payments so they know that you're trying to do the right thing. And secondly, you need to not have exceeded the central bank limits, the debt burden ratio, which is basically says that you shouldn't have borrowings, payments that exceed 50% of your income. Mm-hmm. At that point, the banks will not be able to help you in terms of extra borrowing or rescheduling over different periods of time. So it depends on a number of factors as to what he can or can't do. In many cases, there are options. It's just a case of rejuggling and maybe sitting down with someone who's a little more clear-eyed, because once if you're in the middle of that situation, it's emotional, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's very personal to you, and you can get very upset about it, whereas someone else hasn't the emotional involvement. They can be far more objective and can kind of do the kind of there. Here's what your options are.
And it's these situations are very difficult, but I would also like to say to this person, they're not alone in this situation. I seem to see a lot of this going on at the moment. But how are we getting ourselves into these situations? Is it just us not being very good with our finances? I mean, I totally understand the waiting for other people to pay you, as you know, I do a lot of freelance work, and when you're waiting for other people to pay you, those amounts can start to stack up and stack up and stack up, and you're kind of hoping on a whim that eventually that money's going to come through. But you know, sometimes it doesn't always.
Well, it's tricky, isn't it? I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for people who have small companies, and cash flow is a major problem if you've got your suppliers or your contractors that aren't paying you on time. And that's not very fair, is it? Particularly if you're a large company and you're making a small company wait for money there. There's issues with redundancies, but also I'm afraid there is, as you touched on, Emma, people who are not very good at their finances, who have just taken the offers of loans and credit cards and not thought ahead about the having to repay, because this is not free money. It all has to be repaid.
I'll just bring up this message that we received during the week from a lady who said her husband had a credit card with a limit of 200,000 dirhams, which is crazy. He obviously not good with the plastic and just kind of saw it as free money, really, not understanding the interest amounts. With the interest amounts on some of these credit cards are, let's face it, it's horrific if you don't understand what you're doing. And basically went out, spent the limits to the credit card, ended up taking out a personal loan to pay off the card, because at the end of the day, the interest on that was far less. Mm-hmm. And you might as well take a giant pile of money, stick it in your living room and set fire to it in the amount of interest you're earning, racking up a month on these things. But it's tough, isn't it, when we get caught up in this live on credit kind of way of thinking. People do think, and when we get badgered by a lot of institutions going, have this credit card, have this loan, it's very easy to get wrapped up in that.
It is. And this, we do live in a very consumer culture, and we do see the adverts from the banks pushing and promoting. And we saw a lot of offers over Ramadan and Eid suggesting that people should go out and spend large amounts of money and have a credit card to do it. Now, I happen to think that is morally wrong to be pushing things in that way. I understand the banks have a business to run. Loans and credit have been around for a very long time, and that's fine. But there also has to be a responsibility, a culpability from the banks, as well as on the individual. It's not just one or the other. As adults, we do have to take responsibility for what we're borrowing, and knowing that we have to repay it. It's unfortunate if someone is made redundant. That's a slightly different situation. But we have to have an eye to that here as well. And we're in a global economy that is not as secure as things were 10, 20 years ago. There is no such thing really as a job for life. Mm-hmm. So we all have to be aware that things could go wrong and have provision for that, and not be in a position where we're suddenly unable to meet all our debts and immediately going into debt and behind on repayments within a month of losing a job. That's a terrible situation to be in.
And one thing I wanted to bring up with you, because it's, again, going back to the forums that I look for things, that I see an increasing number of people looking to private lenders. So away from the register, the banks and the financial institutions. Ooh, and then yes, looking at, let's face it, let's call them what they are, the loan sharks.
Yes.
But I'll give you an example as to why a lot of people are basically looking at this. So there was a message from one person saying they were in the UAE for quite a few years. They have a good job, have no debt. They needed to take out a loan equivalent of several times the monthly salary. Good reasons for needing it, and basically approached the bank, but because the company they work for isn't whitelisted, the company wouldn't give this person a loan. So can we start off explaining what is the whitelisting and why are banks only looking at people who work for certain companies to lend them cash?
Right. What the banks are looking at here, and this is not based on the individual and their creditworthiness, but it's their employer and therefore the security or the potential security, we should perhaps call it, of their employment. If someone is working for a very large company in a business sector that is considered more secure, then that company is more likely to get the tick against it. We're happy to lend to their employees. Whereas if someone is self-employed, they work for a small company, or perhaps that company banks with that bank as well, and they've not got a great credit history, they've been late on payments, all these things will be flags to the bank, and they'll go, yeah, you may fit the criteria, but we're not sure about your security of employment, so we're not going to lend to you. It's sort of a preferred employer type situation. Now, just because one bank declines you doesn't necessarily mean that others will, but what it will often mean is that there will be a higher rate of interest attached to that loan because it's a perceived higher risk.
Sure. And if you moved banks to take out a loan with another bank, would you then be expected to pay your salary into that bank?
In most cases, yeah. It's in the small print of loans where it says that you must be paying your salary into that bank. And I've seen issues in the past where people have had the bank requesting immediately repayment of the full amount because they've transferred bank for their salary. Mm-hmm. And they've basically broken the terms of agreement. So that's quite a common one. And again, understandable from a bank's point of view. They want to make sure that the debt or the money that they're lending is actually paid immediately and it is paid off as a priority each month.
So it can be a little bit chicken and egg scenario.
It can. I mean, there is also the question of underwriting the individual, that they're going to be looking at their outgoings. And it may well be that particular person has been spending all their money every month as far as the bank can see. So they've been taking it all out. Now, it may well be that they've been taking money out to transfer it to another bank account, and that maybe they can explain to the bank that that's where it's gone. Mm-hmm. They're not just spending it all, because if you think from the bank's point of view, if they see your money coming in and all of it going out and then pretty much a zero balance at the end of the month, if they lend you money with a repayment of X many thousand a month, how are you going to pay it?
Yeah, exactly.
It's you've got to think about it from the bank's point of view as well at that point in time. So there's sometimes ways of getting around it.
Do you know how much the new Etihad Bureau credit check rating system is going to help this? Is it going to help this in that banks will then use it and maybe move away from the whitelist system?
I don't think they'll move away from it, but I think there will. It is certainly being used by banks, and we can all actually go and get our own credit rating done online from the Etihad Credit Bureau, which is all up and running, and there's a few years history on there now. What the banks will probably be doing is running that to see if someone's got a good or bad track record, and that will lead to different interest rates being applied. So if you've got a great credit score and you want to borrow and it's not a large amount, you're going to get a much more competitive interest rate than someone who has missed the odd payment in the past.
Sure. We've just had a text message come in saying, live within your means. If you can't afford it, save your money until you can.
Wise words.
It's a nice sentiment, but do you ever find that you save and save and save, and then there's always that one or two things, one after the other, that just wipes everything out?
There's always something. There's always something. And things don't come along on their own, do they?
No.
There's suddenly two or three things. That's why we've all got to have that emergency fund so we can do that and then get on with it. But yeah, it's all about planning.
It is. Welcome back to Dubai Today. And of course, we do have our financial Wonder Woman in the studio. It's Karen Bobka, senior partner at Holborn Assets and creator of the blog financialuae.me. And we are talking all things finances. We'll get into some of your financial travel tips very shortly. I love the way you've got the Wonder Woman hat on there as well.
How cool is that?
Have you seen the film?
No, I haven't seen the new one.
You have to go and see it.
I'm still all about Linda Carter and the original one, but I found these in a store the other day, and this is fantastic. It's like the headdress and hair and everything. It's brilliant.
Got to put that up on the Facebook page.
Signature.
It'll be great. Right then, let's go to the phones where we should find Alex this morning. Good morning, Alex.
Hey, Emma.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Not bad, thanks. Now, you wanted to come in and say something to Karen this morning.
Well, it was just a mention, a quick mention, really, because I'm rushing to a meeting. But I just wanted to say to thank Karen for all the great blog posts that she puts up on the internet, because they're a great help to everybody.
Thank you. Oh, I'm just really pleased I've got a reader, never mind anything else. So I'm really pleased that people do find these things helpful.
Yeah. And additionally, just a positive mention about the UAE banking system, because it does get a lot of bad press, and it does get, you read posts on the internet and here and there, and it does get a lot of bad press, but, you know, it is a young system, and, you know, you should read the bad press, read the good press, go to the bank websites, and just make a decision about the bank account that you feel is right for you. You know, I sometimes feel that a lot of people, they get into trouble with their bank because they don't know what their minimum balance is. They bounce a check. They're not sure what their card limit is. They don't know the bank opening times. And the problems go on and on and on. But this is basic stuff that anybody, any professional, sensible person that's opening an account should be looking at.
Fantastic advice.
Quite agree.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks, Alex, for getting in touch this morning.
Additionally, Emma, I just want to also say, I can't stress enough also how important it is to build a relationship with your local staff. You know, I'm with an NBD close to my house, close to my villa, and you build relationships with the staff in the bank, and it helps you so much, not to mention learning a few words of Arabic.
We forget about do we forget about that, building relationships with the banking staff? Because we sometimes forget that, or we sometimes under the impression that these days we can just be just a number to banking staff, and that sometimes we need to actually go and have that rapport, whether it's with the managers or the people in the various departments that are dealing with the things we need to deal with.
I think it can be helpful. Now, obviously, you and I, Emma, are deeply unsociable, and we don't want to talk to the bank, and we want to do it all online. But for someone who likes dealing with a branch, as I was saying about, you know, you pick a bank like the one mentioned that has a lot of branches. If that's the way that you want to operate and it works for you, then fantastic. That's what you do. Get to know people. It's a nice bit of human interaction, isn't it? And if there is an issue, then they should be more amenable because they know you. If you're a day late on something, it may not be so much of an issue.
Yeah, so thanks, Alex, for bringing up that point. I think one that we forget about a lot.
Okay, cheers,
all right,
guys.
Thanks, take care, bye. Recognise that voice quite a lot. Alex there, motorbiker and photographer extraordinaire. We've had a text message back in from a person that was having the financial issues, mm-hmm. saying, I'm just one payment behind, which I can catch up.
Okay, that's good. That's positive, because the banks aren't going to be really panicking until you're three payments behind. That's the point at which they can start lodging a police case against someone. That's when it gets very serious. Now, one payment behind, you're going to get phone calls from the bank saying, why haven't you paid? Why haven't you paid? Unfortunately, there are some who go a little too aggressive at this point because there could be a very good reason. But if they can catch up on that, then fantastic. There's definitely, you know, it's worth having a discussion to say, you know, can we get you back online and in a point where you feel that you can breathe and you can manage it? Because that's half the battle, I think.
So good advice there, and good luck with your issues. We hope it all sorts itself out. We've got another SMS in here saying, my bank called me about a four dirham card payment to a particular online entity, then proceeded to block the card to reissue it. What a waste of time, basically. Why would they do this? I've had this, not this particular issue in the past, but normally if there's some unusual activity on your card, your bank normally phones you and goes, asks, did you make this transaction? Is this you? If you say yes, they go, okay, fine, we'll approve it. If not, then they then go down the route of, do you want us to block your card and reverse the payments and all the rest of it? So I'm a bit surprised that bank wouldn't try to contact this person to start off with.
I wonder, maybe they did and they were unable to. That's quite possibly the case. Is, are their details up to date in the system? Now, for four dirhams, okay, that's a silly amount, but that's, yeah, I think, kind of irrelevant, because if that had been a fraudulent transaction, you wouldn't really care if it was four dirhams. But if that was 400, 4,000, 40,000, you would want your bank to take action. And that's the thing. If it's flagged up in the system as a potential problem and they're blocking a card, it is for your own benefit and protection. Because anyone will tell you, if a fraudulent transaction has gone through, it takes time for the bank to go through their investigation procedures. Mm. And you have that money blocked out of your account. You don't want that. So it's actually better that they do take action in this respect. And yes, I accept it. It's kind of inconvenient for the reissuing, although that's normally only a few days, isn't it? So better that they do that just in case than you being stuck with an investigation.
I don't think it's the fact that the reissuing is the inconvenience. It's the, if you've got any monthly payments that are linked to a credit card, you then have to renew all those details, and that can be a bit of a drama.
It is a pain, but it's still there for the greater good. So I think we have to be happy that the systems are in place to pick up on things like that.
And that moves us on quite nicely to our next topic, talking about cards being blocked. Travel tips, money travel tips. One major travel tip that I'd like to point out: when you travel, tell your bank you're traveling, your dates and where you're going, because very often you make do that debit or credit card payment abroad and they block your card because you haven't told them.
Exactly. And then if they have tried to contact you and you haven't got roaming on your phone, they're not going to be able to get through to you to verify that transaction. Then that's an issue. Yeah, it's quite simple to either call the bank, or a lot of banks do have a message system on the online banking, so you can just let them know. They'll confirm that, and they'll know you're out of the country, wherever. It's just one of those little extra things on the list to do, I think, when you go away, that's smart, just in case.
So what else have you got for us, money
travel
tips?
A lot of things, really. I would suggest that in most cases you need to think twice about using your UAE cards overseas, because there are frequently extra charges for doing so. Now, it depends on your bank, on your card, where you are, and what currency you're going to be paying in. But in many cases, you will have an additional fee from your bank. And check with your own bank in each case to see what this actually is. Also, if you're then using it to pay in another currency, that may not be beneficial to you, because you'll normally get a fairly poor rate of exchange. Albeit, you'll find quite often, because global banking systems have become quite sophisticated, that if you want to use a credit card in another country, you'll be asked what currency you want to pay in. So you may have the option to pay in dirhams, even though you're actually, you know, paying in euros or dollars somewhere else. But you then need to have the need to check whether that's a competitive rate of exchange on doing it. Now, if you're going away, for many of us, we'd like to take cash. And I think cash is a good thing to be spending. I know where you're heading with this one, because it allows you to budget. And the advantage we have here, because we have so many exchanges and we're all traveling and we're from different countries, we tend to get, compared to many other countries, quite competitive rates when we're exchanging to other currencies. And I like people to travel with cash, because then you can apportion what you're spending each day, keeping it safe. But there are places where this doesn't work.
Exactly. I went last month, went to Oslo in Norway. They don't like cash at all. They won't refuse it, but they will always go, "Hey, can you not pay by card, please?" They love the plastic. And people literally said, "Do not bring cash to Norway, because you can't spend it, because they won't take it." And I couldn't work out what the reasoning was. And as you were pointing out about the exchange rates and everything, end up using our UAE cards, which of course we got walloped on the exchange rate to the krona. But it also highlighted the issue that what might be a good idea when you get there is to get a prepaid credit card. You can buy them at the exchange houses at the airport on arrival, and then just load them with the local currency when you get there, which might be an option.
I think that's a good idea, providing you're getting a decent rate of exchange.
Yeah.
And in some ways that might be safer than carrying cash, because obviously it depends where you're going and whether you're staying in a hotel room that's got a secure safe in there, that kind of thing. So you've got to consider those factors. And on that point, it's probably fair to point out that the UAE is really very safe, isn't it? We're all quite cavalier about our purses and wallets and all sorts. So if you are moving around and carrying quite large amounts of cash or credit cards, we need to be a little more wary when we're out of the country, because we kind of forget sometimes.
We do, and particularly when you start travelling on other countries, tube trains and metros and all that kind of thing, and you forget, don't leave your bag on the table when you go to the bathroom, because it'll be gone in a nanosecond.
Yeah,
you have
quite
to be
easily.
Really mindful of these things.
Yeah, it's a switch of mentality, isn't it, when you're actually travelling, and I'm very conscious of that. And I'm an optimist, and I think that most people are pretty trustworthy, but there's always going to be one bad apple somewhere, isn't there?
There is.
On doing that. So think twice about that. Now, you can get from here, from a few places, preloaded debit cards in limited currencies. But if you're going somewhere where you're going to be spending in US dollars or euros or sterling, you can get a preloaded credit debit card here to take with you. And if you lose that, that can be cancelled because you get a PIN number like you would do. So you're not really losing the cash, and they can be reloaded. And I think that's particularly useful if you've got children. So teenagers travelling off somewhere or they're going somewhere, you can give them that for security. All they've got to do is remember 4 or 6 digits, whatever it is, to actually spend the money. But again, you've just got to remember that it is real money and just not a piece of plastic that you're handing over on that. Easily done though, isn't it?
It is. We're just on the exchange rates. Karen just had an SMS in saying, I've always been advised when using the UAE credit card abroad to pay in the local currency or you get double the charge. It gets converted to the local currency, then back again, so you end up paying twice.
Yeah. It depends on your bank. I would suggest that in every case you speak to your bank and find out what their costs and charges are. And it depends on where you are and what currency and your bank. There isn't really an absolute hard and fast rule. And I get asked this question all the time, but you need to speak to your bank and find out and get it in writing from them just in case they've got it wrong.
We're talking finances in this hour. We've got Karen Bobka, senior partner at Holborn Assets and creator of the blog financialuae.me in the studio. If you have any questions, do get in touch with the show at the moment because lots of you are traveling and going in and out of the UAE. We're talking about money travel tips. Karen, what's next on your list?
Travel insurance. Something that people don't want to think about, don't want to pay the extra, but oh my, if you have a claim, that's good value for money. I would strongly recommend that people have some travel insurance before they go somewhere. You just don't know what could happen.
And it'll be typical the time you don't have it is the time that something does happen. And
of course,
I've gotten into that. And it's so easy these days. When you book your flight tickets online, there's usually an option, take out the travel insurance at the same time. It doesn't cost a lot. It's well worth doing.
It is. I mean, you may find that if you've got a high-end credit card, you may have cover with that as well. If you travel a lot over the years, it might be worth having a policy that covers you for a full year. It depends. If you're going to go somewhere and your plan is to be terribly active, if you must on a holiday, so if you are going to go skiing or scuba diving, you need to make sure that your plan covers you for those extra levels of risk. We all know people who have gone skiing and broken a leg. Okay, your standard policy will often not cover you because it is deemed an extreme sport. That may depend on how you do it, but that's what it's considered. So it's making sure you're covered for those things. Now, if you've got very good medical insurance, you may find that you've got international cover, and that will cover you for many things, but it won't help you if you need to change a flight, if you need to extend your stay necessarily. So you need to check the small print. And I know it's really boring, and I know no one likes doing it, but 5-10 minutes to check that you've got the right plan, it's worth doing that.
It's invaluable. I don't know why anyone would travel without insurance these days. It's just, as I say, the time you don't have it is the time you come unstuck.
And it's not a lot by comparison to what you're paying to flights and holidays. I know it's another expense, but it's a relative cost. That's what you've got to consider. And if then spending 300-400 dirhams means that your holiday isn't ruined, that's got to be worthwhile, right?
Absolutely. What else have you got for us there?
Travel insurance, obviously. Mobile phones. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure we've all been whacked for roaming costs from wherever we happen to be. These days, you don't have to do that. Now, if you're just travelling for a day, okay, maybe you want to suck up the cost of roaming from one of the providers here because you do get very good cover. But if you're going somewhere for a number of days or a week, get a local SIM card. Many countries, they have them there at the airport on arrival. So you can go up to a counter and say, I'd like a local SIM card, please. They'll even fit it for you. These guys are experts. You'll be fiddling for ages with a paperclip if you do it yourself. They'll take seconds to do it. And then you'll have so much data when you're traveling. It makes it a lot easier to do that. And if you're traveling back to a home country, you can plan it all before you go. In many cases, you can actually order and pay online, have the card delivered to your address. You get there, you switch SIM cards, off you go. You'll keep all the records in your phone, so you can still call the people that you've got in your memory, but it's just using the local data. You'll save a lot of money that way.
What about the international SIM cards in comparison? You know, where you get them from one country, but they have flat rates for use in other countries. Any good in comparison?
I've not particularly looked at them. I know they exist, but it's one of those things, again, you need to check, is it worth your while? I mean, if you are an international travelling type, then that's going to work for you, isn't it? But for many of us who are based here and we just go for a few weeks in a few different places, getting the local card might just be enough to save you a few thousand dirhams over the year. And why not?
And I'm going to throw in a travel tip, a mobile phone roaming for you. When you hire a car in the country you're going to, click the Wi-Fi dongle option. I always use the hire car companies now. They give you the Wi-Fi dongle. In some countries, they're about €2 a day to hire. And then you can stick it in your pocket. And when you're going out and you've got, you don't have to pay your international data roaming the data, the internet, whatever, because you've got the Wi-Fi dongle. It's cheaper.
And I think it's a really good idea to have data packages when you're traveling, because then you can do things like down currency exchange apps on your phone and to work out what the exchange rate is today and what you're buying. And if you're traveling around, you've got, the map system, so you know where you're going. There's a lot of convenience in that. And again, translation options. All these things are really useful if you're traveling to just give yourself a better experience, I think.
Absolutely. Anything else on your list?
Just one that sounds really obvious, but gets overlooked is, do make sure you've got sufficient validity on your passport when you're going somewhere. How often do I see people going, oh, I'm going to such and such, but I've only got 4 months. Will I be able to get in? And the answer is invariably no, unless it's a home country. It is pretty standard across the globe now that you need to have 6 months validity on a passport before you can enter a country.
Okay.
So don't assume that it'll be all right, because it often won't be. What will happen, you'll get to the place, the airport, and the airline will not allow you to get on board because they have to take legal responsibility for allowing someone on a flight with the correct visas and validity on a passport.
And I'm thankful that you brought up visas, because my follow-on question for that was, because I've seen quite a few people asking the question, I'm planning to travel on my summer vacations. My residence visa has expired or is expiring. Can I still travel?
Oh, now that gets complicated.
I know.
Yes, I've come across a few of those. It's hard. If your visa is in the system, has been cancelled and reissued, you're probably going to get pulled at the airport and asked why. Now, that's not a major problem, because you just simply need to explain what's going on and you're generally let through. And I've had that issue myself before, and I just kind of cheekily said, oh, my PRO is not really, really up to speed and I've got a problem there and I'm really sorry. And they were like, off you go, and let me through. But you need to be aware that this could be an issue, that if your visa hasn't been fully cancelled, you're going to have a problem coming in or out of the country, because it'll be picked up in the immigration system. And if you're at a point where you're switching over from visas, I would say the smart thing to do is to get something in writing to explain that's ongoing. Mm-hmm. It's not that the people at immigration want to be difficult, but they want to make sure that someone's not trying to abscond. That's
sure.
Really what it is. So think about the dates of when you're traveling and what's in your passport and visa. Incidentally, coming into the UAE, generally, you need to have a minimum of 3 months on your passport if you've got a current residency visa. It's a little more amenable in that respect. But for people coming to visit you, they do need the 6 months.
Wow. And on that note, unfortunately, Karen, we've run out of time. Where did the hour go?
That was fast, wasn't it?
It was. So I hope there's lots of advice in there for people travelling over the summer months if you are going away. Hope you have a wonderful time. Karen, once again, thank you very much for coming
in. My pleasure. Thank you.
And see you next time.